Listening test. You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions. And you'll have time to check your work. At the start of each recording, you'll hear this sound. You will hear each recording twice. The test is in two parts. At the end of the test, you'll be given 2 minutes to check your answers. Part 1. You're going to listen to the recording. Before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
In today's lecture, I'm going to be talking about microplastics. Microplastics are tiny pieces of plastic smaller than 5 millimeters in size. Recently, there's been a greater awareness that there are large quantities of plastic waste, big and small, in the environment. The amount of plastic waste in the oceans has received widespread attention. But far less is known about the effects of microplastics in freshwater and particularly in soil. Microplastics can enter the environment via a number of different sources. Threads and microfibers detach from synthetic clothing every time they're put in a washing machine, and these find their way into the water system. Other sources include big pieces of plastic waste that are already in the environment, and these break down into microscopic particles over a period of time. On a larger scale, factory waste is another route, as are tyres, which wear down as cars, lorries and so on travel along road surfaces. We already understand some of the impacts of microplastics from studies involving fish and other animals. There is evidence that microplastics harm small creatures in a variety of ways, such as by damaging their mouths or by impairing their ability to feed, for example, when microplastics get lodged in their digestive system. Surprisingly, perhaps, it is likely that humans consume microplastics, as these have been detected in a wide range of food and drink products, including bottled water, as well as in water that comes direct from the tap. What's more, salt and many kinds of seafood have also been found to contain microplastics. However, it's important to underline that there is not yet conclusive proof that microplastics cause significant harm to people. In many countries, including here in the UK, there is legislation which prevents manufacturers from adding plastic microbeads to shower gels, facial cleansers, and toothpaste. It is very difficult to accurately estimate the total amount of microplastic particles in the soil, as they can be hard to detect. But we do know they are carried in the air and deposited in the soil by rain. What's more, many of the fertilizers used by both farmers and gardeners contain microplastics. A team from the Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge has carried out a study of the effects of microplastics on the digestive tracts of earthworms. These worms, which live in topsoil, are an essential component of our agricultural system. By feeding on soil, they mix nutrients into it, thereby making it more fertile. The researchers set out to discover whether the introduction of microplastics into the soil and the subsequent ingestion of these by earthworms would impact soil quality and ultimately inhibit plant growth. The short answer was yes, it did. After placing 3 different types of microplastic particles into the soil, they planted perennial ryegrass. The particles of microplastic which included biodegradable PLA and conventional high-density polyethylene, or HDPE, were then ingested by the earthworms in the soil. The result was that the worms lost weight rapidly. What's more, a lower percentage than normal of the ryegrass seeds germinated, and the researchers concluded that this was a direct result of the earthworms being unable to fulfill their normal role in making soil more fertile. The team also discovered that there was an increase in the amount of acid found in the soil, and this was attributed mainly to the microplastic particles from conventional HDPE plastic. The conclusions of the study make for very interesting reading. I've included the reference in the notes to give you at the end of this session. To summarise, the authors proposed the idea that we need to regard soil as we would regard any other process in nature. This means we should accept the implications of soil being dependent on decaying and dead matter constantly being passed through the bodies of earthworms. That is, when soil becomes impoverished by the presence of microplastics, not only ecosystems, but also the whole of society are negatively impacted.
Now, listen to part one again.
In today's lecture, I'm going to be talking about microplastics. Microplastics are tiny pieces of plastic smaller than 5 millimeters in size. Recently, there's been a greater awareness that there are large quantities of plastic waste, big and small, in the environment. The amount of plastic waste in the oceans has received widespread attention, but far less is known about the effects of microplastics in freshwater and particularly in soil. Microplastics can enter the environment via a number of different sources. Threads and microfibers detach from synthetic clothing every time they're put in a washing machine, and these find their way into the water system. Other sources include big pieces of plastic waste that are already in the environment, and these break down into microscopic particles over a period of time. On a larger scale, factory waste is another route, as are tyres, which wear down as cars, lorries, and so on travel along road surfaces. We already understand some of the impacts of microplastics from studies involving fish and other animals. There is evidence that microplastics harm small creatures in a variety of ways, such as by damaging their mouths, or by impairing their ability to feed, for example, when microplastics get lodged in their digestive system. Surprisingly, perhaps, it is likely that humans consume microplastics, as these have been detected in a wide range of food and drink products, including bottled water, as well as in water that comes direct from the tap. What's more, salt and many kinds of seafood have also been found to contain microplastics. However, it's important to underline that there is not yet conclusive proof that microplastics cause significant harm to people. In many countries, including here in the UK, there is legislation which prevents manufacturers from adding plastic microbeads to shower gels, facial cleansers, and toothpaste. It is very difficult to accurately estimate the total amount of microplastic particles in the soil, as they can be hard to detect. But we do know they are carried in the air and deposited in the soil by rain. What's more, many of the fertilizers used by both farmers and gardeners contain microplastics. A team from the Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge has carried out a study of the effects of microplastics on the digestive tracts of earthworms. These worms, which live in topsoil, are an essential component of our agricultural system. By feeding on soil, they mix nutrients into it, thereby making it more fertile. The researchers set out to discover whether the introduction of microplastics into the soil and the subsequent ingestion of these by earthworms would impact soil quality and ultimately inhibit plant growth? The short answer was yes, it did. After placing three different types of microplastic particles into the soil, they planted perennial ryegrass. The particles of microplastic, which included biodegradable PLA and conventional high-density polyethylene, or HDPE, were then ingested by the earthworms in the soil. The result was that the worms lost weight rapidly. What's more, a lower percentage than normal of the ryegrass seeds germinated, and the researchers concluded that this was a direct result of the earthworms being unable to fulfill their normal role in making soil more fertile. The team also discovered that there was an increase in the amount of acid found in the soil, and this was attributed mainly to the microplastic particles from conventional HDPE plastic. The conclusions of the study make for very interesting reading. I've included the reference in the notes to give you at the end of this session. To summarise, the authors proposed the idea that we need to regard soil as we would regard any other process in nature. This means we should accept the implications of soil being dependent on decaying and dead matter constantly being passed through the bodies of earthworms. That is, when soil becomes impoverished by the presence of microplastics, not only ecosystems, but also the whole of society are negatively impacted.
That's the end of part one. You now have 20 seconds to check your answers. Part 2. You're going to listen to another recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
Okay, everyone, I'm going to let Dr. Stafford take over for this part of the class to cover the topic of big data and health. Dr. Stafford, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. I'd like to thank Professor Lee for inviting me to speak to you today. As she said, I'll be talking to you about big data and health. To begin with, we really need to clarify what we mean when we say big data. As you know, there's more data available about people and their activities today than ever before. That's largely thanks to the internet, social media, communication devices, and monitoring devices of all kinds. So, big data simply means large sets of data that we put together for specific purposes. One way to visualize all this data, this big data, is as a giant, fast-moving river. The huge amount of data or information is like water. Water that everyone needs, but it's a wild river that's not necessarily easy to control or access. We need to somehow get that water out of the river, treat it to make it clean and pure, run it through a very complex network of pipes, and then direct it into homes and businesses so people can use it for various purposes. Like this giant, fast-moving river, this huge collection of different types of data has enormous potential to serve various needs of people. However, like the water in the river, in order for big data to be useful, it has to be treated by being analyzed, and different pieces of this information need to be distributed to the right people. Currently, the main focus is on collecting and storing medical data, data that is accurate and can be trusted. But it's not an easy task, as reliable information, well, it isn't always easy to obtain. There are a couple of challenges here. One is that until recently, lots of health information has been self-reported. It's a funny thing, but patients have a tendency to be dishonest when they report their own personal health information. Psychologists say it's because they want to make themselves appear healthier than they actually are. Another issue is that even if the data is accurate, some people are reluctant to share this information. They're concerned that it won't be treated as confidential. The first problem of self-reporting can be addressed by collecting factual information only, such as weight measured in a doctor's office or blood tests done in a lab. Health monitoring gadgets are another great source of reliable data. The second issue, the one of confidential information, is being addressed by the development of increasingly effective data security technology. At the moment, the number of businesses specializing in the collection and storage of health data is growing by leaps and bounds, and hundreds of millions of dollars are being invested in this area. But we need to keep in mind that all the medical data in the world is useless unless doctors receive it in a form they can use, such as patient profiles or software to help them with decision-making. They don't have time to sift through the data and analyze it themselves. Organized information is what doctors really need. Unfortunately, comparatively little money is being spent in this area at the present time. However, one group that is working toward making big data more accessible is the Pittsburgh Health Data Alliance. They're working on profiles that collect all the information doctors need in a form that's easy to access. The problem is that the amount of data on patients is becoming overwhelming. One way to address this is by using artificial intelligence, or AI, to analyze and interpret all that data for us. AI programs are able to interpret big data to provide a diagnosis for certain diseases more quickly and effectively than doctors can by comparing symptoms or combinations of symptoms with similar cases in vast medical databases. What this could mean is catching diseases at an earlier stage, thereby saving more lives. However, let me stress that we haven't yet reached the point where a computer can replace a doctor. Even ideas suggested by AI programs can't be trusted without being tested in the real world, on real people, in studies supervised by doctors. And although big data will undoubtedly continue to enhance the work of medical professionals, it's still no replacement for old-fashioned medical science. But in the future, doctors will probably consult data on a patient's genetic information, lifestyle, and environmental factors to help determine the best choice of treatment. In the years to come, we'll probably see big data facilitating the development of effective treatments in various ways. For example, it'll probably help create new pharmaceutical drugs and be used to select the best participants for studies to test those drugs. In fact, certain effective drugs have already been created thanks to data sharing arrangements between some of the world's largest drug companies. Let me highlight the guiding principles such projects follow. The more data, the better the results. Lastly, big data can help with patient follow-up care. It's been confirmed again and again that certain patients are simply reluctant or unable to follow their doctor's orders. Big data is used to determine who these patients are. And while it has traditionally been difficult to monitor patients in follow-up care, new apps keep track of where they are, whether they're taking their medicine, how well they're sleeping, and even their psychological state after they've left the hospital. I think you'll agree that big data has immense potential to greatly increase our understanding of disease and our ability to treat it. There are so many important changes just around the corner. That's what's so exciting about the medical field today. Thanks for your attention. Now I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Now listen to part two again.
Okay, everyone, I'm going to let Dr. Stafford take over for this part of the class to cover the topic of big data and health. Dr. Stafford, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. I'd like to thank Professor Lee for inviting me to speak to you today. As she said, I'll be talking to you about big data and health. To begin with, we really need to clarify what we mean when we say big data. As you know, there's more data available about people and their activities today than ever before. That's largely thanks to the internet, social media, communication devices, and monitoring devices of all kinds. So, big data simply means large sets of data that we put together for specific purposes. One way to visualize all this data, this big data, is as a giant, fast-moving river. The huge amount of data or information is like water. Water that everyone needs, but it's a wild river that's not necessarily easy to control or access. We need to somehow get that water out of the river, treat it to make it clean and pure, run it through a very complex network of pipes, and then direct it into homes and businesses so people can use it for various purposes. Like this giant, fast-moving river, this huge collection of different types of data has enormous potential to serve various needs of people. However, like the water in the river, in order for big data to be useful, it has to be treated by being analyzed, and different pieces of this information need to be distributed to the right people. Currently, the main focus is on collecting and storing medical data, data that is accurate and can be trusted. But it's not an easy task, as reliable information, well, it isn't always easy to obtain. There are a couple of challenges here. One is that until recently, lots of health information has been self-reported. It's a funny thing, but patients have a tendency to be dishonest when they report their own personal health information. Psychologists say it's because they want to make themselves appear healthier than they actually are. Another issue is that even if the data is accurate, some people are reluctant to share this information. They're concerned that it won't be treated as confidential. The first problem of self-reporting can be addressed by collecting factual information only, such as weight measured in a doctor's office or blood tests done in a lab. Health monitoring gadgets are another great source of reliable data. The second issue, the one of confidential information, is being addressed by the development of increasingly effective data security technology. At the moment, the number of businesses specializing in the collection and storage of health data is growing by leaps and bounds, and hundreds of millions of dollars are being invested in this area. But we need to keep in mind that all the medical data in the world is useless unless doctors receive it in a form they can use, such as patient profiles or software to help them with decision-making. They don't have time to sift through the data and analyze it themselves. Organized information is what doctors really need. Unfortunately, comparatively little money is being spent in this area at the present time. However, one group that is working toward making big data more accessible is the Pittsburgh Health Data Alliance. They're working on profiles that collect all the information doctors need in a form that's easy to access. The problem is that the amount of data on patients is becoming overwhelming. One way to address this is by using artificial intelligence, or AI, to analyze and interpret all that data for us. AI programs are able to interpret big data to provide a diagnosis for certain diseases more quickly and effectively than doctors can by comparing symptoms or combinations of symptoms with similar cases in vast medical databases. What this could mean is catching diseases at an earlier stage, thereby saving more lives. However, let me stress that we haven't yet reached the point where a computer can replace a doctor. Even ideas suggested by AI programs can't be trusted without being tested in the real world, on real people, in studies supervised by doctors. And although big data will undoubtedly continue to enhance the work of medical professionals, it's still no replacement for old-fashioned medical science. But in the future, doctors will probably consult data on a patient's genetic information, lifestyle, and environmental factors to help determine the best choice of treatment. In the years to come, we'll probably see big data facilitating the development of effective treatments in various ways. For example, it'll probably help create new pharmaceutical drugs and be used to select the best participants for studies to test those drugs. In fact, certain effective drugs have already been created thanks to data sharing arrangements between some of the world's largest drug companies. Let me highlight the guiding principles such projects follow. The more data, the better the results. Lastly, big data can help with patient follow-up care. It's been confirmed again and again that certain patients are simply reluctant or unable to follow their doctor's orders. Big data is used to determine who these patients are. And while it has traditionally been difficult to monitor patients in follow-up care, new apps keep track of where they are, whether they're taking their medicine, how well they're sleeping, and even their psychological state after they've left the hospital. I think you'll agree that big data has immense potential to greatly increase our understanding of disease and our ability to treat it. There are so many important changes just around the corner. That's what's so exciting about the medical field today. Thanks for your attention. Now I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
That's the end of part 2. Time's up. Thank you.